to Shack Sunday Live with me, Linda Hayden, host of the Pack Woman podcast. Forgot my own podcast name, it's fine. And this week I am joined by my Tour to Shack family, Caroline West from Glow West, Vicky Conway from Policed in Ireland, and Tonya Martin from the Echo Chamber podcast. Remember, you are only here because you're a patron. So if you want to join us, come and sign up at www.patreon.com/TorchShack. You can be here every week with us having the crack. It is the highlight of all of our weeks. So we have a lot to cover this week. So we are going to kick off. And Martin, I'm going to come to you first. Talk to me about the new appointment in the press office.
Okay. The Taoiseach, in his wisdom, has decided to appoint the former editor of the Sun newspaper as his government press secretary. Now, the Sun newspaper, I shouldn't really have to say any more than that. Most recent controversies would be what they said about the Muslim problem in the UK, and that went into the British Houses of Parliament, and it was ripped asunder. They just simply edited some nonsense survey to be able to put a shock headline up there. They called AIDS the gay plague back in the day. They called for the Birmingham Six to be hanged back in the day. How can our Taoiseach have that as a government press secretary? How can it happen? And then Hillsborough. I mean, what they said about the people from Liverpool and Hillsborough, unforgiven, never, ever, ever, ever forgiven, ever. And to have him as government press secretary, I think it's disgraceful. And I think it's a story that's going under the radar. Why are they going for the absolute scummiest scum of the earth?
There's not much there, Martin.
Oh, it's really scum stuff, and we've seen it this week. We have seen this absolute, and I'm not singling out one party, I'm saying everybody's at it. But the precipitation of this real going after people's wives and stuff like that's the fucking Sun newspaper. Rid of it, bygone. That's me shut on it. Thanks.
And I think you've kind of covered nearly everything that there is to say about that there. Like, just watch out for the spin. Watch the way it's going to go. Things are going to get really ugly.
Ugly and nasty, and people, you know, made shit of. And we don't really want that.
No, absolutely not. So moving on to the next topic, we are going to talk text messages. Now, I seem to remember a good few weeks ago when questioned in the Dáil if there were any other text messages between Matthew Atuhu and Leo Varadkar, that the Taoiseach told Eoin Óibrín that there was nothing more to see. So we're joined on the line by Jack Horgan-Jones. And Tony, what do you think of this?
Well, I thought, Jack obviously put up the story yesterday, which showed that there was a lot more contact and it was kind of very informal. Jack, you might just comment actually on the FOA itself and what those messages revealed.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can indeed.
Fantastic.
And now we've gone on mute.
It says tap to speak and then it says done speaking. So I vowed early in the pandemic not to learn or become good at any of these kind of Zoom things because I thought there might be extra work, so I remain profoundly unqualified in all this stuff. So if I disappear or stop talking or anything like that, just I don't know, send me a WhatsApp. I can use WhatsApp, and so can Leo Varadkar.
I love it.
Professional segue.
Yeah. We published a story yesterday outlining effectively the fruits of an FOI that I put in shortly after the controversy kicked off in late October, early November. And I FOI'd the Department of the Taoiseach and asked them for, it was pretty broad in terms of topic. I just asked for any email, WhatsApp, text message conversations between the Taoiseach as he was then and Matthew O'Toole between two dates. And I think April of 2019 and I think maybe May of, May of 2018. And these came back. Effectively, there's three different there's three different conversations that were caught up in the FOI, two of which relate to the kind of ongoing negotiations that have been underway between the government and one of the GP groups, the Irish Medical Organization, on a new pay deal for GPs. And another one relates to a kind of business proposition that Matthew O'Toole was kind of peripherally involved in. And what they show effectively from the most interesting one is an exchange between the two men in the 11th of October, 2018, which was just kind of after the budget. And remember, this was a budget that had extended free GP care to about 100,000 people who hadn't been afforded it before. And that forms the backdrop, with Matthew O'Toole saying, look, you know, GPs are furious about this. And then they go from that into discussing the deal that was at that time under negotiation between the IMO, which Matthew O'Toole wasn't president of, and the government, which obviously Leo Varadkar was in charge of. And we see this thread here whereby Matthew O'Toole kind of invokes the idea that GPs might actually actively campaign against Fine Gael and for Fianna Fáil going forward. So we see that the representative groups are not shy about playing politics here. We know that they did this before, because during the controversy it emerged that they had made this veiled or perhaps unveiled threat to Fine Gael TDs in early 2019, effectively saying, look, if you don't get on board and give us what we want, we're going to start campaigning against you guys. And he goes into some detail. He says posters in the waiting room, handing leaflets to patients and placing posters on lampposts. And Varadkar comes back and kind of says, look, you know, who will they be campaigning for? Sinn Féin and the leftists want you all on salaries and not big ones, not big ones being maybe 60 grand a year. So you get a kind of insight. And look, there's no point in going through a blow by blow of the text and line by line. But you get an insight into, I suppose, two things. First of all, you know, the kind of cut and thrust of high level lobbying by influential organizations of powerful people, and also the kind of the easy back and forth, which I suppose is reinforced by the fact that the two men had a personal friendship and knowledge of each other, you know?
Yeah, Jack, just on the what's crucial there is the word you've used is lobbying. Okay, because it fits every definition of lobbying. It actually, I know we're trying to summarize this for the purpose of listeners. Shay Bowes comes into focus because he's talking about the care from home enterprise that himself and Matthew O'Toole were looking to launch, and that was obviously a way to try and say, well, look, this is something that we could do, and Matthew spins it to Leo Varadkar as something that you guys should claim credit for. You know, get on board with this now. That there's something.
I think what's interesting about that though is, like, I mean, you clearly have a situation now whereby, you know, you have this Community Hospital Ireland project, which Shay Bowes was working on. Shay Bowes, who was the originator of a lot of the documents that were given to Village Magazine that led to this farrago in the first place. Shay Bowes, and we know he'd been in dialogue with Matthew O'Toole about potentially getting involved in CHI. And now you have Matthew O'Toole seemingly making representations, framing the CHI project in a positive light to Varadkar. I mean, what's interesting is that, I mean, being frank, Varadkar doesn't really display an awful lot of interest in it. Certainly, the text messages that we have show him asking one question: "What is it?" And then, as far as I can tell, it looks like O'Toole sends him a PDF describing it, and then we don't have anything more under FOI. So we can only presume that no further interactions occurred after that. But it's a complex and convoluted web, you know, with strands spinning off in all different directions. And I suppose it's interesting that every time we get something like this back, we understand maybe a little bit more of what's going on in the background.
Well, I suppose if I'm going to sum it up from my point of view, it's a peep behind the curtain, surely, of how how this operates. And it calls into question what SIPO are going to do now when they look into the matter. It surely has to be added to that.
I think you raise an interesting question, right? So you need to have a look at the definition in legislation of what is and isn't lobbying, because it is prescribed in the 2014 Act. And I know that there have been successful attempts, both on behalf of industry and behalf of government, to have dialogues and to narrowly interpret what's going on as not lobbying for purposes of the Act and therefore not disclosable in a submission to SIPO or to the lobbying register. So it is possible for private industry or lobby groups to narrowly define their activities and to talk to politicians without it becoming disclosable. The question is whether that is something that A, somebody might make a complaint to SIPO about, or B, SIPO might proactively take an interest in. Now, it is important to point out as well that under the Lobbying Act, the disclosure obligations and the obligation to lodge that that form with the Standards and Public Office Commission does lie with the lobbyer, not the lobbyee, for want of a better expression. So it would be, if such an obligation was created by this activity, it would be beholden on O'Toole, not on Varadkar, to disclose.
Yeah.
But we also know that there was 159 different instances where the person who has been put onto the board at SIPO lobbied on behalf of the NAGP. So there's a number of different things going on here. So they you have O'Toole definitely lobbying as he was. There was the lobbying going on that was officially going under the Lobbying Act. And then we know from Che Bowes, when he was on with the Echo Chamber guys there last week, he also said that the government had no interest in this initiative, the home care initiative that they were trying to do, because it was not for profit. And they thought the government came back and said it wouldn't be taken seriously because it wasn't for profit. So it's a real good insight into what's going on in terms of the government and the commercial interests that the government have, and the money side of things, you know, what they deem, you know, you're not going to get any money from the leftists, you know, it shouldn't be about the money.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the good fun things about this story, these particular texts. I mean, it does show a kind of a fairly unvarnished insight into you know, Varadkar's views, Leo Varadkar's views, and, you know, the pejorative terming of leftists, and, you know, the characterization of GP Anger as irrational. You know, I mean, it does illuminate something of his character, you know, and the characterization as well of, effectively, there was a lot of pay talks going on at this time. And in addition to talking to GP groups, the government was also in dialogue with nurses groups and consultant groups. And the kind of offhand characterization of this by Varadkar is, you know, we need to cut a deal with you soon, only a limited pot, and nurses and consultants are much more effective at getting something from it, you know. So one would imagine that the nurses and consultants groups would raise an eyebrow at that, and that kind of ties another thread of this whole piece into the story, which is, you know, how it might affect industrial relations negotiations going forward, and whether it will kind of, you know, sour the watering hole, and whether people will be happy with, you know, in the first instance, how they were characterized in this kind of, you know, quietly mercenary sense. But secondly, you know, that there were these kind of dialogues going on in the background, and whether, you know, similar dialogues would have been available to the heads of other lobbying organizations, or whether this dialogue and this access
you're being very polite about it. We'll choose to believe our version of events is that this is how business gets done in so many ways in this country. It's a great insight into it, and, you know, again, shows the value of getting those FOIs in and getting the information.
Yeah, but I mean, look, at the end of the day, I mean, I think it shows one of the core truths about politics in Ireland, which is that access is massively important, and access is sometimes determined by personal connection as well as, you know, who you represent or your politics. Like, and I think that's why you see revolving doors between politics and lobbying. And I think it's one of the things that the likes of SIPO are trying to clamp down on, and adding more visibility to these processes is important to the functioning of the democratic process. And that's why it's good to get this stuff out into the public domain, you know.
Jack, you said it was between a couple of dates that you have sent that FOA in. So can we take it that there is more to come on this?
I put in a clatter of FOIs. I'm just looking at my emails here. I put in loads after. I tell you what, I do know that Sinn Féin, so that this is going to go off in a couple of directions from here, I think. I know that Sinn Féin put in a very extensive FOI request just after this, looking for not just communications between the two men, but I think, you know, communications between the department and the trade group. So I would imagine that there is a kind of cache of documents coming their way. And similarly, I think the health committee has made a request to the Department of Health looking for a lot of the documentation relating to this deal. So I don't think we're even into the second act of this yet. And I would imagine that given the weight of stuff that's going to come back, I'd be surprised if there weren't more stories, perhaps between now and Christmas, but certainly in the new year.
Excellent. A little nod to Ken Fox for tidying up FOI this year. Well done, Ken.
So, guys, we're going to have to move on. Jackie, thank you so much for your input there. And we're going to have a chat next to Aoife Martin. Aoife, hi, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It is, to me, it looks like it's been a bad week to be a trans person. How are you?
I'm okay. It's bad week to be a trans kid, I think. I'm old enough and I'm thick-skinned enough and I'll be fine. But I do worry about other trans people and other trans people coming after me, especially younger trans people. What's happened in the UK is very, very scary, what's going on over there. And the fact that the Irish media seems to be trying to import that culture war that they're having over there around trans issues into Ireland is very, very scary. It's not a good look. You know, we should be learning by their mistakes, but as usual, we're just repeating them.
So talk to us a little bit about what happened this week. There was a ruling, Kira Bell.
Yeah. So there was a judicial review against the Tavistock Clinic in the UK, and this is a clinic that deals with transgender children and sort of assesses them and determines whether, you know, they should be put on puberty blockers. So for those of you who don't know, puberty blockers will stop the onset of puberty for these children. So if it would stop, say, a trans girl from getting a deep voice and from all its sort of secondary sexual characteristics that come in with puberty, it would stop a trans boy from getting periods and growing breasts. So these things, as you can understand, would be very, very dysphoric for a young trans child. What happened with the Kira Bell judgment is that they decided that the puberty blockers were a bad idea and that trans kids should go through puberty, which would be very, very distressing for them. Puberty is distressing enough anyway, but when you're trans, it's even more so.
Yeah, it is absolutely shocking. And the thing is that the healthcare, so we already know that trans healthcare is really poor in this country as it is. So talk to me a little bit about the delay on the report as well, because there was a government report into trans healthcare that was due out February, wasn't it?
February or March, yeah, I think. So basically there is a trans healthcare steering committee. So there's representatives from the This Is Me campaign on that committee. There is representatives from TENI on that committee. And, you know, they produced a report around trans healthcare. You know, this was in conjunction with the HSE. So, you know, we thought we had, you know, all the people involved that we needed. And, you know, I don't know what's in that report, obviously, because there's, you know, restrictions around and there's non-disclosure agreements around it. But this was supposed to have been published, like you said, February or March. I can't remember which it was. And there's been no sign of it, you know. So there's been pressure put on the government around this, pressure being put on the Minister for Health. So Simon Harris was the Minister for Health at the time, but it's now, what's his face?
Donnelly.
Yeah, Stephen Donnelly. And so that report seems to have just disappeared into the ether. But, you know, the Taoiseach came out and said this week that the report should be published. So it'll be interesting to see if anything happens around that.
That they're great at saying reports should be published and they're still not.
I seem to remember when the Taoiseach was Minister for Health that he lost a report behind a radiator at one point. I can't remember what that was about, but I remember when he was there, there was a report went missing and it was found a few months later behind a radiator. So yeah, who knows?
So talk to me a little bit about what's happened in the media this week, because I think for me, looking at it, that was the bit that stuck in my craw the most, you know, like watching people literally platforming transphobes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, since the Cure Bell judgment, you know, there's been a number of articles in the, especially in the Irish media. Like, so we've had Stella O'Malley. She's been on News Talk. She's been in the Irish Independent. You know, I mean, you know, Stella O'Malley is not an expert in this area. You know what? You know, instead of platforming and talking to trans people, you know, we just have the same people giving their opinions on these issues. You know, so, and even, you know, even places like the Irish Times, who should know better and who you would expect to know better, you know, are just voicing opinions from columnists and without any regard for trans people whatsoever. I mean, Jen O'Connell had a piece in the Times yesterday where she dead named a trans person, you know, and this is basic stuff. You know, it shouldn't happen in this day and age. And I don't accept the excuse that she didn't know what dead naming was. You know,
that was my biggest thing. You cannot be a journalist and not know what dead naming is.
Exactly. And even if you know, just reach out to a trans person and say, look, could you just review this for me? Like, I've had people in ordinary jobs from ordinary walks of life send me stuff and say, look, would you mind just reviewing this and making sure the language is okay? And these are just ordinary people in ordinary jobs. They're not journalists. Why can't journalists do that? Why can't they say, any trans person would be happy to review it and go, yeah, that language is fine or this is problematic. And straight away, they would have picked up on the dead naming thing. You know, so there's no excuse for it.
I mean, like, so Google is also a thing, you know, it's like, yeah, asking Google you to do friend. Extra labor to have to review. Like, that's a lot of labor on you and reading maybe potentially very upsetting things. So they could just Google, like, dead naming is not a new phenomenon. Like, no, that's not. That's a long time thing. So literally 5 seconds on Google. I mean, you're a journalist.
Yeah.
Or God forbid, you know, their employers have like training and standards around these things.
Well, that's it. Even when it was pointed out, and you know, so Jen sort of apologized. It was I'm sorry if I offended you, sort of thing, apology. But the article still hasn't been changed. I mean, well, at least not since the last time I looked, it hadn't been changed or hadn't been updated. I mean, that dead naming is still there, you know, and it's just not acceptable in this day and age.
You would think if you were going to write an article on transgender and research it, that dead naming is one of the very basic things that you would have learned.
Yeah, no, basically.
The other thing, though, I want to say is fair play to the Examiner. And I have to say, the Examiner is playing an absolute blinder in how they're showing true allyship over a load of different things in the last year. Well, in a long time, but they're really to the forefront, and very much enjoyed your article yesterday.
Thank you. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I give out about the media a lot, but the Examiner really, you know, did a full page yesterday where they spoke to actually to 3 trans people. I was lucky enough to write an article for that page, and I think it's wonderful. They are showing their allyship. But then, you know, I look at the papers today and I see Brenda Power in the Sunday Times comparing kids with gender dysphoria to kids with anorexia. I see the Observer newspaper, which should, you know, be on our side, you know, because they're more left-leaning than the other UK media, saying that the Bell judgment was correct and that trans kids shouldn't have access to puberty blockers. So, I mean, it's just, you know, there is an all-out culture war against trans people out there, and we are buying into it, and we have to put a stop to it, you know, and we have to call it out.
Shaq calls it out. We're not buying into it.
No, and no, we stand behind trans people all the way. We've had self-ID in this country for 5 years with very little problems. That these boogeymen that the trans exclusionary radical feminists from the UK seem to go on about on and on and on about. We haven't had those issues. We refuse to accept it here. And, you know, we need to be shouting louder as allies. To make sure that this doesn't happen, because, you know, I've spoken to a lot of trans friends this week and everyone's very worried. So we're sending love and solidarity to you.
Well, I mean, thank you so much. And I really appreciate all the work that you guys do. And yeah, I mean, I'm generally not one for scaremongering, but it is very worrying. And I've spoken to older, more experienced and more, trans people, and they are very worried that this is starting to creep in over here, you know, so... We need our allies to stand up and to stand with us.
Yeah, because you're not going to have a loud enough voice by yourselves because the amount of people who are shouting you down. So it's down to all of us to get behind you and amplify.
Can I just come in on one point that, and again, as someone who knows very fucking little and is proud to admit that I'm trying to learn it anyway, the idea though that it's well financed is something that was new to me this week when we spoke to Lilith on the Echo Chamber about the money that's coming in from conservative groups in the US to influence, and they have a playbook, and that's where we're always well behind the curve here. We're reacting instead of being proactive. So I suppose, and it goes back to what one of the comments here saying, you know, allyship has to be all singing, all dancing in 2021. Yeah. I think that's the way it has to be. It's one thing to say, I'm reminded what Bernadette McCaskey said. Someone said, solidarity is all well and good. Saying I'm standing behind you is all well and good, but how far behind you am I standing? So we need to stand with people. And not just behind them, absolutely shoulder to shoulder. And let's try that. That's my little pitch anyway.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say that the corruption is probably the wrong word, but the links between feminism and conservatives and far right people, this is nothing new. So they're like, you know, if I'm reminded of a lot of the anti-porn feminists who would have been quite, you know, termed themselves as radical feminists, but they would have absolutely been in bed with conservatives who would have happily seen them burned at the stake for their feminist views in other areas. But yes, when it came to something like porn, they were absolutely well in bed together and taking a lot of money from them, a lot of platforming from them. So this is more the modern approach of that. So if you scratch that surface and look at who's actually funding this, you know, like, that's pretty concerning. And a lot of people who would absolutely throw feminists under the bridge the second that they get that chance. So Bear says best pun ever, in bed together.
Absolutely. I mean, and just to come in on that a little bit, like, you know, the funding is coming from sort of right-wing conservative, you know, Christians and conservative think tanks. And, you know, and the ruling in the UK, what people don't realise is that ruling will have an effect on abortion for kids. You know, that this is, you know, this Gillick competency that they're talking about. You know, they could say, well, you know, a child can't determine whether or not they should have an abortion or not. You know, so this is going to affect abortion, which feminists are supposed to be for, you know, supposed to be pro, but, you know, these guys aren't. They want to eradicate trans people. I mean, it is as stark as that.
It strikes me very much like white feminists, where, you know, white women want to raise themselves up to the same level as white men and fuck everybody else. And this is the same kind of thing to me. Do you know, like, when you see the transphobia, when you see the sex work exclusion, you know, all these kinds of things, the people who are engaging in this kind of stuff are only out for what's in it for them. And if it doesn't affect them, they don't want to know.
There's a lot of money to be made in a career being anti whatever it is. The anti-porn feminists have made a long career and gotten a lot of money and a lot of careers, but normally they would have been shut out of it. And now it's like they're making money off writing articles about trans people. They're making money off going to conferences around it. I mean, someone's paying for those flights. Someone's paying for those articles to be written. So it's a little bit of a spider's web that we might have to do a bit of untangling of.
So, Eva, thank you so much for coming and talking to us at short notice as well. So thank you.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
And the best of luck for the rest of the week. We're all standing with you. So we'll be there.
Thank you so much.
So, Caroline, let's talk orgies.
My favorite topic. This is the news. On the surface, I was absolutely delighted to see this news because it was just ridiculous. So this is a Hungarian politician, Jozef Scheuer, who was caught in an orgy of not one, not two, not three, 25 men. I mean, talk about greedy, you know. He was caught trying to escape from it when they got busted by sliding down a drain pipe with a bag of drugs. And I just, that has every ingredient for an amazing political story that just, you know, tickles my fancy on every level. But, you know, when we scratch that surface, it's obviously a lot deeper and a lot more concerning. So this guy is part of the, and I'm going to butcher the name now, the Fidesz party in Hungary, which are just right-wing, awful humans. But this guy himself, he drafted the Hungarian constitutional prohibition on gay marriage. So we can see that, again, that deep-seated internalized homophobia. And we see this all the time. You know, there's a lot of politicians who will draft these kind of laws and then are caught with, you know, male prostitutes, male sex workers, you know, or in long-term gay relationships. And it's just, it's mad how it's still continuing, you know, kind of going on and stuff. But obviously he knew this was the end of his career because he resigned immediately, but just, yeah, the hypocrisy and the damage that these people do. Like, fair enough, okay, right, if you have your internalized homophobia, go off and deal with that yourself. But if you're drafting the constitution on, you know, banning gay marriage for other people, then you're just an absolute piece of trash. Like, you don't deserve your orgy of 25 people. They're only for good people. We only want orgies.
Talk about the COVID implications of an orgy.
Yeah, the hypocrisy of that too. Like, of, you know, again, we've all suffered. Some of us might have wanted to have 25 people orgies, but we stuck to the COVID rules. And, you know, this, so again, one rule for one rule for another. Yeah, someone in the comments, there is a very famous American senator who is known as Lady G in some certain areas. And I'm not going to say anything else in case I get sued, but has like a history of male sex workers. And he is one of the most virulent homophobes.
Which is funny about that is actually because they will name that individual in the US and we can't name them here because of our defamation laws. And yet you're on other shows. They will definitely just, they will go further than Lady G. Interesting to see how restricted we are. And I think the whole Fidesz party really must be rocking now on the idea that, you know, this is the internalized homophobia that actually is their own problem. Sorry, Mark.
Is it not just all grift? They're getting the money from the hard right. The hard right want them to be anti-gay, so they'll be anti-gay regardless of what they are themselves. It's just pure grift.
No,
it's
principles, grift. Like, but just money.
Yeah.
They also banned, I think, gender studies in Hungarian universities as well. So, or at least they're trying their best anyway. I don't know if they've actually succeeded in banning it, but that was like one of the first moves that when they came to power, they were like, right, we're getting rid of gender studies.
Isn't that so worrying that, like, Eastern Europe seems to be in the grip of this very conservative far right? And obviously there's money there in that. So, you know, is it going to spread? Are we going to end up with things like that? Like, we can see people trying to bring it here and it's not really working so far. But, you know, will they wear it down?
There are some examples of some internalized homophobia in some of our far right people around here, and anti-trans discourse as well, and the same anti-gender studies, anti-sex education. Like, they're very similar threads. So, yeah, it's just trash. It's all about money as well and their own internalized stuff. And maybe they'd be a bit happier if they just took a bit of therapy instead.
Yeah. What I always say, who benefits from it? And if you follow the money, you'll see who benefits from it. Yeah. So we will move on to the next topic, which is busy week in the Oireachtas, Vicky.
Yeah, I really want to talk about, which is, and I don't mean this in any bad way, but about Helen McEntee's pregnancy, because I think there's something hugely interesting here. So not just the kind of historic first government cabinet minister to give birth. I know Moira Gegenquin, but she was Minister for State, I think. But there's something more going on here. I mean, obviously it's unusual enough to have a woman who could potentially get pregnant in a position of such power. And like, it's a really, you know, she's in one of the heaviest ministries, the Ministry for Justice. But what I kind of love about it is the choice that she's made. I mean, when I think back myself, like, I've thought, God, things like the Policing Authority, the Commission of Future Policing, I couldn't have done those if I had young kids. It's too demanding. It's too hard. And I think a lot of women do still impose those restrictions on themselves and what they can have from their lives. And a lot of that is externally imposed as well because of, like, you know, childcare and supports and all of that kind of thing. And I get that she's in a relatively privileged position, but it's not that privileged either. Like, TDs don't have a right to maternity leave, you know? We don't, there are no structures in place. And I absolutely love that she has said, I'm having my child, you know, I'm not giving up on my dreams for the sake of serving my state. And I think that's how it should be. And we want women to feel like this is all possible. But there's a massive gauntlet thrown down to government now to do this right. Because it is a serious, significant ministry with, you know, so much coming on, and she needs proper supports and all of her rights to maternity leave and everything to be protected, and her other rights during pregnancy. But, you know, this can't be a case of dumping this ministry on another colleague for a little while she's on leave. Like, this has to be done right. Otherwise, the work doesn't get done right and resentments grow. So I think it's going to be, there's a real moment here for the cabinet to show some leadership and get this right and make that statement to the country about how mat leave should be respected and handled and, you know, not just filler posts and all of that kind of thing. So I think it's pretty, it's a really interesting moment, and how the government reacts will send a really significant message to women. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't treat this right...
I went to a Women in Politics thing a couple of years ago, and they actually brought, I can't remember which TD it was, which is an awful shame. And she was talking about being a mother and being a TD and the barriers to that. So they have a creche in the Dáil, but it's only open until 6 o'clock, and they're mm-hmm. there till 11, 12 o'clock an awful lot of the time. So, you know, there's that barrier there around childcare and being able to access, and Bear's just said it's tiny, so you know you probably couldn't be able to fit all of the kids in there. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if like Jacinda Ardern did it, you know, it was Jacinda Ardern mm-hmm. did it,
yeah.
You know, and maintained her role as a prime minister while being having a baby and dealing with the whole mat leave thing. So I think, you know, there's a lot to do from the Dáil perspective to make sure that the equity is there. Because we know that we still need caucuses for women within the Oireachtas, because there's only,
it's what I keep saying. We don't, like, I mean, I get the feminist movement, but would you not be happy with just a bit more progressive patriarchy, no?
No, Tony.
Can I just say that?
There's going to be war afterwards.
The WhatsApp group is going to be lit. But with Jacinda Ardern, like, that obviously, like, the achievement that she had was absolutely huge. You know, like, it's hard enough running a country and it's hard enough having a baby. And when you combine those two and managing it, but, you know, to be careful not to put that pressure on pregnant people of like, you can do it all. You don't have to have extensive maternity leave. You can do your job and maternity leave at the same time. And this is what a lot of self-employed people have to do. They have to work that way. And creches are ridiculously expensive. And, you know, I know for in academia, the creche that was in DC was like, again, tiny, massive waiting list. You know, you're lucky if you get a spot.
But even with that, you take academia, and if somebody goes on parental leave of any form, but obviously mat leave is for much longer, the work just gets dumped onto other colleagues, which causes resentment. So people, you know, get annoyed, and mat leave is a pain, and it's all of this, which is why the government needs to deal with it properly and put the structures in place so that that isn't felt. But it also raises, and you're so right, Caroline, but it's those broader social questions about why women in Ireland do kind of 80% of the care work, and the need to absolutely shift that. And I mean, obviously, good news this week, Roderick O'Gorman announcing up to 9 weeks of parental leave and encouraging their men to assume, men and, you know, lesbian partners or whoever, to assume those roles so it doesn't all fall on the woman. But it's a huge social shift that has to occur as well.
They could start by getting rid of the Dáil bar and turning it into a full creche to reflect the times that we live in and to encourage women to stand for politics.
Yeah, fully agree. Guys, we're going to have to move on. So we're going to cover one last topic before we move on to our hero of the week. So Tony, I'm going to come to you to talk a little bit about Brexit. And I know you tried to get Ursula this morning, but she wasn't available.
No, yeah, I tried to get out Ursula von der Leyen, but she wasn't answering. No, actually, I want to say first and foremost that Dawn Foster was supposed to join us, but as people might be aware, she has had a couple of issues in terms of her own health, and she has had a little bit of an accident with herself. So get well soon, Dawn, and we will talk to you over the coming days. But yeah, just to point out that the idea now that this is all coming down to fish. And the idea around and fish stocks and fish quotas, I think there's a lot of tokenism going into that, a lot of jingoism going into that, you know, as if this is just to be seen to have delivered some sort of victory. And as I think it was Aidan Regan pointed out this morning in the Sunday Business Post, the City of London doesn't give a shit. Okay, and that's where that's what drives it. It's the it's if the financial hub is driving it and they're unaffected, it doesn't really matter. And you know, we've known this. I've said this on this podcast several times. They priced in a no deal Brexit already, you know, a number of nearly 18 months ago. So, unfortunately, the island of Ireland is going to be majorly impacted. Even with a deal, we're going to be majorly impacted. And without a deal, it'll just be worse. And then I want to put that into context as well. I don't know if anybody spotted it during the week that Ireland is potentially going to be the fastest growing economy in the world again this year. Yay! And what does that tell you? You know, in the middle of a global pandemic, that our economy still grows. So there is a huge disconnect to the two-tier economy that we have in this country. And the idea of what's happening with Brexit, I actually think they know it won't impact it so much, because a lot of those companies, be it our FDI, our multinationals and our pharma and the likes of which, we'll be able to move along. The final thing I'll say in it, though, is that none of this is going to tackle what Don and we were supposed to hoping to mention, was the fact that the UK's underlying economy is terrible. They are suffering in recession, and they already have levels of deprivation and levels of poverty that are actually worse than what we have and what we campaign against. So it's just important that we kind of don't lose sight on the actual key issues that affect people around the dinner table. And we keep talking about fish stocks and about, you know, the EU getting a GDPR deal with the UK, because that's what they're talking about now. And that stuff won't affect you around your dinner table, really. We need to be much smarter and see what the real game is that's going on in the background.
Brilliant. So just one thing to point out before we go on to our hero of the week, and that is we are having a Christmas party, and it's on next Friday at 9:30, and we're inviting all of our patrons to it. So there is a post on the patron.
I'll put up another one.
So Tony's got to put up another one. You literally need to email for your bingo cards, because we're having Ringo music bingo. And it's going to be great crack. So get your glad rags on, get your Christmas jumpers, put your onesies on, wear whatever you want. And we'll have absolute crack next Friday night, 9:30. So we hope you all join us then. So
we've got loads of spot prizes as well.
Yes, we have some spot prizes.
Including lube.
Yeah. Watch Tony cringe. You get the lube for the corners.
He cringes without it, trust me.
Oh. Just pick on Martin. He's thrilled.
Right. My hero of the week is Caroline West for making Tony cringe every day.
I told you, I'm
about to record a podcast on face sitting, and I think you need to. Caroline, who's your hero of the week?
I'm going to put the soppy romance on because it's my 1 year wedding anniversary today. So my hero of the week is my husband, who's currently in Make Me Lunch. It's all lovely. And we've actually managed a year together of basically spending 24/7 together since lockdown in March. And he's been minding me through COVID and just generally not minding me talking about our sex life on national radio and TV, and when he's a very private person and I'm absolutely not. So he puts up with a lot. So he's my special hero of the week.
Oh, Martin, who's yours?
My special hero of the week is a man called Paddy Brophy. Paddy was my granddad, who died 33 years ago, and he would have been 100 this week. He was raised by a lone parent. He was a union organizer. He organized men in 5 counties in the county council into unions. He got them basic rights, and he has always been my hero, always.
Brilliant. Vicky?
I'm going to go with Carabelle. A tough week, but so courageous taking that case, going there. Really important. Yeah.
Fully agree. Tony?
I'm going to go back to Vicky, because I don't know if you guys spotted it, but yesterday, Vicky, the story of Niall was in the Irish Examiner in a special report, and that family have had more positive reinforcement, and the opportunity for change is actually there now. It's tangible, and it could help another child. It could help another family. And it wouldn't have happened if Vicky hadn't been committed to actually bringing those stories and putting them at the center of what she does. So that, there you go.
Yep, fully agree. Our hero of the week is Dr. Vicky Conway. So we are going to stop recording now for the people on non-patron. Off you go. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to become a patron, you can, and you can join us live, and you can come to our Christmas party. It's www.patreon.com/torchchat.